So here's three short passages from the Gospels. The first one from Matthew 5. You have heard Jesus is speaking. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. 1 John 4 says, dear friends, let us continue to love one another, for love comes from God. Anyone who loves is a child of God and knows God. But anyone who does not love does not know God, for God is love. And then John, the Gospel of John 13, 34. So now I am giving you a new commandment, Jesus says, love each other. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other. Again, we've been focusing on a new humanity, this invitation to get out of, to step out of the old dysfunctional way of being human, to leave hate behind, to not choose dehumanization, but to find a love that is even capable of loving our enemy. And if I'm honest with you, this has been a really challenging series to preach. Not because the scriptures are hard to figure out on this, they're quite straightforward. That's not been the difficult part. What's been difficult is hearing these words and figuring out how to actually live them out. Not only that, it's been difficult at times, at least for me, to even have the motivation or the desire to love my enemy. And maybe that's been somewhat true for you in some way, shape, or form as well. These words have been difficult to hear or hard to implement. I want to read you a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., who wrote a sermon titled Loving Your Enemies. He says this, probably no admonition of Jesus has been more difficult to follow than the command to love your enemies. Some people have sincerely felt that its actual practice is not possible. It is easy, they say, to love those who love you, but how can one love those who openly and insidiously seek to defeat you? It's an honest question, isn't it? Coming from someone who knew, maybe better than most of us, I would say almost certainly better than most of us, what it is like to be attacked day after day in very real, frightening ways by your enemy. But the question I think he's getting at is does Jesus actually mean what he says? You know, I mean, is Jesus saying this with a nod and a wink? Hey guys, you know, love your enemies. I know I'm just kind of saying that because I have to say that. Or is this actually legitimate? Does he really mean it? I think a lot of that has to do with how we understand the word love and what kind of love Jesus is talking about here when he gives us this command. Because love, that word, that one word, means widely different things depending on its context, right? Loving the Detroit Lions or that new sweater is not the same thing, of course, as loving a grandparent or a dear friend, even though it is the same word. In English, love has different meanings depending on its context, and that is also true in the Greek of the New Testament, but even more so, because in Greek, there are actually three separate words for love that we find in the New Testament. You've maybe heard this before. Let me run through them quickly. One of them is the Greek word eros. It speaks of a romantic love. And then we have philia, a reciprocal love between friends, between people who share the same values, who have history and relationship. And when you look at both of these kinds of love, I think you'd agree, right? That they include a great deal of positive emotion. Romantic love, oh my gosh, it's only positive. You are head over heels for someone, intoxicated in all the best sorts of ways for someone, right? Philia, this deep love rooted in trust and time and values and relationship, there's also plenty of good feelings associated with philia. And so when we hear Jesus command us to love our enemies, we might think that we are being commanded to feel good, positive emotion for our enemy, that we're somehow supposed to be drawn to them or maybe want to hang out with them. But friends, this is really, really important to understand. And maybe it's where I should have started in the first week of this series, to make clear that loving our enemy is not necessarily all rainbows and kittens. Jesus doesn't intend for it to be. When he calls us to love our enemies, he's not asking us to feel all warm and fuzzy for those who are opposed to us or who have hurt us. Nor is he asking us to always agree with our enemy. Nor is he asking us to turn a blind eye to their harmful actions. Nor is he asking us to allow injustice to continue. When Jesus commands us to love our enemy or to love our neighbor, for that matter, whomever your neighbor might be, he does not use the Greek words eros and philia. He uses a third word, agape. And volumes have been written about this word, many ways of defining it. But this morning, I want to use a definition penned again by Martin Luther King Jr. Because I think Dr. King, for him, loving your enemy was not an abstract question, just an intellectual idea to ponder. This had real world on the ground, day-to-day implications for him. And so his definition carries a lot of weight in my mind. And he defines it this way, that agape in the Greek means a creative, redemptive goodwill for all people. Let's break that down for just a quick hot second, creative. King is saying that love has to be creative. It must involve our imagination. It must include brand new original ideas. And I think this is brilliant because we all are very familiar with the old ways of being human, of hating your enemy, of belittling your enemy, talking down about them, gossiping about them, undermining them, dehumanizing. We understand those ways. We're very familiar, and we easily just slide into those old ruts. King says something new has to be imagined. Something creative, innovative has to be birthed. Then he says it has to be redemptive. Love must be always moving towards change, transformation, and renewal. So if that isn't happening, if whatever you are doing or saying is not moving towards or aiming towards redemptive things, it's not love. And thirdly, it's rooted in goodwill, which is wanting the best for someone and being willing to be cooperative and even compassionate toward them. See, King says, you don't have to always agree with your enemy. In fact, as we'll see in a little bit, sometimes you shouldn't agree with your enemy. But that doesn't mean that you have to treat them absent of goodwill. You can want the best for your enemy and still confront them. That's possible. So, what does this kind of love look like? Let me give three examples here this morning that I hope put some flesh and blood on this bone, this framework here. If you've been alive and living in the United States the last few months, you've had ample opportunity to encounter an enemy. Okay? I know I have. And like Dr. King, I think that this is probably the hardest thing that Jesus asks us to do, to love our enemy. And I would also add that I stink at it. Okay, so I'm not coming to you as some expert. In fact, if I'm just transparent, I rarely have an agape kind of love for my enemy. And it usually starts with an absence of goodwill, right? If I am romantically in love, goodwill is easy. If I am talking about philia love, also, goodwill comes naturally. But if I'm talking about that coworker who keeps one-upping me in front of my boss, or who isn't pulling their weight on the project, or that student at my school who every time we're on Zoom or we're in class, they make a little joke, a little dig against me just to try and get a laugh, or that family member of yours that's been harmful and hurtful to you, right? With our enemies, goodwill does not come naturally. And so King says, well, guess what, friends? We may have to get creative in order to find that goodwill that can lead us toward redemptive steps. So here's something I've been trying intermittently, often not doing this, but here's something I've been trying to do with my enemies the last few months. Whenever I encounter an enemy, I've been trying to say these three words, 5 years old. And that has been encouraging me to think of my enemy as a five-year-old. As a child, scoring their first soccer goal. Or sitting at their birthday party with a cake and candles lighting up their face and people around them singing happy birthday. Or on the playground getting bullied. Or walking through the store hand in hand with their parent. For me, I know this is not like Picasso level creativity. If you're thinking that King is asking us to create some masterpiece when he is talking about us being creative, he isn't. But he is asking us to think in a new way or to come up with new ways of thinking and interacting with our enemy. And so this has been one thing for me, and it's transformative. Because if I think of my enemy as a child, someone who was once a child, it helps me humanize them. They don't just become someone to fight against or an object in my way. They become a person again. And that doesn't solve everything, but it opens the door to the possibility that I might then be able to take redemptive steps toward them instead of harmful or hurtful steps. For example, when I am able to see my enemy as a person, a human being with a history and a past, someone who's had wounds and joys and all that it is to be human, for me, a conversation becomes at least possible then. But if I don't do this creative exercise, again, this is just creative for me, and it might not work at all for you in any sort of way. But for me, if I don't do this, the idea of a conversation isn't even on the table. It's not even on the table. So I've tried to get creative, and it's helped plant the seed of goodwill. And sometimes, not as often as I'd like, but sometimes it even leads to steps that might bring about change. Here's another example. It's a very different one. In 1963, Martin Luther King was leading a series of nonviolent protests and sit-ins in Birmingham, Alabama, to stand up against the city's racist policies. And days into these protests, a judge deemed that the marches and the sit-ins were illegal. Well, King and those working with him decided to practice civil disobedience, and they continued to protest anyway. 9 days into the marches, he, King, and many others were arrested. And while in jail, 8 white Alabama clergy, 7 of them Christian, 1 of them Jewish, wrote an op-ed, not directly to King, but clearly about him, criticizing him and the protest movement. And King went all agape on them. He does something that I think is quite remarkable and instructive, at least to me. Remember, agape is creative. So King gets this newspaper handed to him in his prison cell, in his jail cell. He reads this op-ed of these 7-8 clergymen, and he decides to reply to them. Problem is he has no paper, no typewriter. So he gets a pen and he starts writing a letter of response in the margins of the newspaper that he's been handed. And when he fills up every margin, he then looks for scraps of paper, pieces of receipts, whatever guys there in the jail had that they might be able to hand to him. And he starts writing on these scraps of paper. Finally, his attorneys are able to get him actual pieces of paper. And 20 pages later, he has a response. That to me is quite a creative move, quite a creative act. And it was redemptive as well. Everything about this letter is focused on transformation. Here's one section of the letter. I must make 2 honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the last few years, I've been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I've almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate. Ooh. If you don't know, when he says white moderate, he is directly talking about these 8 clergymen and every other white moderate who in a lot of ways seemed sympathetic to this work of justice, but always were finding ways to oppose it or to critique it or to ask it to stop or to slow down. King says, I think this actually is the greatest impediment to justice. And so in case you couldn't tell, this is highly confrontational. Would you not agree? I mean, if you've ever wondered, you know, isn't love kind of a squishy, rainbowy, kitten-y sort of emotion? And if that's the only idea you have of love, I'd invite you to read this letter. If you've ever been worried that the call to love our enemy means that we should let our enemies perpetuate injustice, I'd invite you to read this letter. King does not let them off the hook. He calls out their apathy. He names their obstruction, all in the hope, here's the key, that these brothers and sisters would see the truth and would change. It is a creative, redemptive response. And it is also full of goodwill. King is forcefully confrontational. Love sometimes demands that of us, that we would confront our enemy. But King's letter is void of any hate. Read it carefully and you will not find 1 ounce of cruelty or viciousness, just the opposite. King treats all people, even his enemies, with good will. Here's how he closes the letter. If I have said anything in this letter that is an overstatement of the truth and is indicative of an unreasonable impatience, I beg you to forgive me. Wow. And then he says, I hope this letter finds you strong in the faith. I also hope the circumstances will soon make it possible for me to meet each of you. In other words, if I get out of jail, not as an integrationist or a civil rights leader, but as a fellow clergyman and a Christian brother. Let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities, and in some not too distant tomorrow, the radiant stars of love and brotherhood will shine over our great nation with all their scintillating beauty. Yours for the cause of peace and brotherhood. It's just dripping with goodwill. King finds a way to balance confrontation and truth with also compassion and wanting the best for his enemy and for the world. This is agape love, and King demonstrated it, but he was not the originator. King is following the lead of someone else. He's very clear about this. You know, a few minutes ago we heard those words from John 13, 34, where Jesus says, so now I'm giving you a new commandment, love each other, agape love. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other. Again, this comes from John 13. John 13 records the final night of Jesus's life. A night when his closest friends will do the unimaginable. They will, in fact, do the things that you might expect an enemy to do. They will sell him out. They will refuse to stand up for him. They will abandon him. In his greatest hour of need, they are nowhere to be found. These, again, are not the actions you would expect of trusted friends. And yet I want you to notice how Jesus treats them in John 13. Jesus got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. In his final hours, Jesus decides to not just tell his disciples to love each other with an agape love, but he shows them what it looks like. And the washing of his disciples' feet is creative, it is redemptive, and it is rooted in goodwill. It's creative in the sense that the person in that day and time who would wash the feet of a bunch of guests was the lowest servant on the ladder. That was the way that things were done, the old way of doing things. And Jesus says the old way isn't working. So he gets creative. He gets innovative. He does something no one would have expected. And it is redemptive. He says, now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. See, this act that Jesus demonstrates, this act of love, it not only changes the individual disciple, it's transformative and redemptive to them, but it actually changes the way that they view leadership. And therefore, it ends up changing the world. So we have a few examples here this morning. 5 years old, you can take or leave that example. It's my best one at the moment. King's example, Jesus's example. I wonder, what does this look like in your life? And I want to invite you into a time of prayer, but a time of prayer that's done with our eyes open and a pen in our hand. I want to invite you to grab a pen, grab a piece of paper, or that's not available to you, or you're a digital person through and through, grab your phone, open up a new note. We're going to take a few minutes to pray, to be reflective, to be open. And as we do that, I want to just ask three questions and invite you to respond to them by writing or typing, so that this becomes, as it was for Dr. King, not just an intellectual exercise, not just an abstract idea, but something that we make concrete in our lives today and tomorrow. So here's the first question I want to ask you to consider. Who is your enemy? I want you to actually write this down. And you might have more than one. And it could be that your enemy is someone or someone's, a group of people out there, like it was for King, the white moderates, right? That was a group, an amorphous kind of group of people that were really standing against and harming not only the movement toward justice, but King himself. And maybe for you, it's your enemy is something like that, a group of people, a political party, people who think that way, or people who say those kinds of things, or people who have that kind of idea. Who's your enemy? Maybe it's some group out there, or maybe, like it was for Jesus, it is someone close. This is often the case, that the one who's in opposition to us is someone who's in our same home. And that can ebb and flow and, you know, but who might it be for you today? I want to invite you to write that down. Make that concrete. Put a name down. No one else is going to see this. You're not turning this in. We're not going to ask you to type it in the chat window. This is for you. For you to be open here as we pray to what God may want to say to you. That question maybe is easy or easier. Now, this one might require a little more reflection, or maybe not. Maybe you can identify quite quickly, what old ways are you stuck in? Sorry, it's not quite grammatically correct there. What old ways are you stuck in? Here's another way to ask that question. What do you typically do when you encounter this enemy? I want you to write this down. Make it concrete. Don't let it just live up here where it can come and go, where you can try and bury it deep. Put it on paper. Look at it. What do you typically do? What's your default reaction when you are encountering this person or this group of people? What do you say? What do you do? How do you feel? What old ways are you stuck in? What's your default? I think for me, what's coming to my mind right now is that I just shut my enemy out. Stop listening, stop paying any attention. Give them nothing of myself. And you know what? Sometimes that may be what's needed, but I think I choose that default too easily. That would be an old way that I'm stuck. And then this third question, how can God's Spirit help you be creative and redemptive? This is the brilliance of King. Love is creative. It finds new ways of expression. Love causes us to say things or do things that maybe we haven't done before in an effort to try and move closer to redemption, whatever redemption looks like in our particular case. So maybe a step to take, an innovative step, a creative step, is to start using new language about your enemy. We've been talking about this on and off the last month and a half. Maybe you only are responding to your enemy in a certain form of communication and shifting to a different kind of communication, getting offline, for example. Maybe that might be helpful. Is it a creative action, you know, some step that you haven't taken, a thing you could actually do? Maybe it's a new idea about your enemy, something you haven't thought of before. I wish I could tell you, just kind of go down the list of whoever's on today and say, yep, for you, you should do this. And for you, you should do that. And well, it looks like, lucky for me, that's not my job. You know, this is where we trust the Spirit of God, where we lean in and where we open ourselves. And we stay after it, believing that God is in fact going to give us creativity about how to love well. I want to invite you to keep thinking about these questions as we listen to another song that Kevin has done, and I think it is an appropriate way of kind of wrapping this time up before we move into communion. So keep reflecting on these questions. Keep jotting notes while the song's going on. Maybe the song will prompt an idea. But if you turn off your video, as many of you have already done, you're so astute. We'll listen to this song together.